Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We've got some current events. We're checking in on Hollywood as well as the royals, and then we'll move to the politics section. We're going to start with one of the craziest stories this week. The headline reads, Jillian Lauren Schreiner, wife of Weezer bassist, shot by police and arrested for attempted murder in L.A. This is by Casey Wickman, published on April 10th. Jillian Lauren Schreiner, wife of Weezer bassist Scott Schreiner, was involved in a bizarre and dangerous situation with the Los Angeles Police Department outside her home in Eagle Rock, California, Wednesday afternoon. According to a Wednesday LAPD press release, officers were looking for three suspects in a hit-and-run incident and arrived in Schreiner's neighborhood. The 51-year-old, who recently underwent a hysterectomy and other surgeries to treat an unspecified form of cancer, according to a March 4th social media post, met police while holding a handgun. According to the media release, Schreiner was told to drop the gun repeatedly, did not, and then pointed the gun at the officers. She was shot by police, resulting in a non-life-threatening wound. She then reportedly went into her house and emerged after some time with another woman. She was then arrested, taken to a hospital for treatment, and booked for attempted murder in absentia. She was released that evening on a $1 million bond, official records show, and is due on felony charges in Los Angeles Superior Court on April 30th. According to a local CBS affiliate, Schreiner told police that she had had the gun because she was defending her home from the hit-and-run suspects they were looking for. LAPD did not return Vanity Fair's request for comment. Schreiner is an author, and under the name Jillian Lauren, her middle name, has written two memoirs, Some Girls, My Life in a Harem, and Everything You Ever Wanted, about her earlier life as a call girl to the Prince of Brunei, a novel, Pretty, and most recently a true crime book, Behold the Monster, about serial killer Samuel Little. Schreiner's manager did not return Vanity Fair's request for comment. She and her husband, Scott Schreiner, are parents to two sons, whom they adopted, and she's an advocate for adoption. She frequently posts photos of her family on her social media accounts. Her husband has been the bassist for the rock band Weezer since 2001 and is set to perform with the band at the Coachella Music Festival on Saturday. Management for Weezer did not immediately return Vanity Fair's request for comment. There was also some sad news announced this week. This headline, Eric Dane reveals an ALS diagnosis before returning to the Euphoria set. The 52-year-old actor, also known for his role in Grey's Anatomy, began shooting on the HBO hit's third season in just 3 days. This is by Savannah Walsh on April 11th. Eric Dane, best known for playing emotionally tortured hunks on shows including Grey's Anatomy and Euphoria, has been diagnosed with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, also known as ALS. Just days ahead of his April 14th start of filming on the long gestating third season of HBO's Euphoria, Dane told People magazine, I have been diagnosed with ALS. I'm grateful to have my loving family by my side as we navigate this next chapter. ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, is a rare neurodegenerative disease that weakens a patient's ability to control muscle movement, speak clearly, and eventually breathe independently. There is no cure for ALS, and people typically live for 2 to 5 years after diagnosis, according to the ALS Association. However, some patients can live for a decade or more beyond that window. The 52-year-old is married to fellow actor Rebecca Gayhart, with whom he shares two daughters, 15-year-old Billy and 13-year-old Georgia. We're best friends. We're really close, Gayhart told E! News a day before Dane publicly shared his diagnosis. We are great co-parents. I think it's important to not look at a relationship that ends as a failure. Gayhart filed for divorce from Dane in 2018, but filed to dismiss the petition just last month. We're still married, but together for 15 years, and we had two beautiful kids, she said. So I think that's a successful relationship, and that's how we look at it. Dane, who found fame playing hotshot plastic surgeon Dr. Mark Sloan, a.k.a. McSteamy, on Grey's Anatomy, Went on to lead the TNT naval series, The Last Ship, and appear in films including Burlesque and Bad Boys, Ride or Die. His most prominent recent role has been Euphoria's Cal, the closeted, embittered father of Jacob Elordi's Nate. I don't know what it's like to be Cal, but I know what it's like to live a double life, Dane told Vanity Fair in 2022. I've had my own experience with drug and alcohol abuse, and that's a double life. He's been open about his experience with addiction, voluntarily entering rehab in 2011 for a dependency on painkillers following a sports injury. Trying to keep that secret is tough, Dane continued. Eventually, everything always catches up with you. Dane will now return to the part after another life-changing event. I feel fortunate that I'm able to continue working, and I'm looking forward to returning to the set of Euphoria next week, he told People. I kindly ask that you give my family and I privacy during this time. Our next headline, for the record. Michelle Obama addresses those persistent divorce rumors yet again. In a podcast interview with Sophia Bush, the former First Lady spoke about her decisions not to attend Jimmy Carter's funeral or Trump's inauguration. This is by Casey Wickman on April 10th. One more time for those in the back. Michelle Obama and former President Barack Obama are not getting divorced. In an interview with Sophia Bush's on Sophia Bush's podcast, Work in Progress, published Wednesday, the former First Lady clarified that just because she's not always physically with her husband, she's still with him. Alluding to her absence at both the state funeral of former President Jimmy Carter in January and the inauguration of Donald Trump later that same month, which her husband attended solo, Michelle stood beside her decision to skip the occasions. I chose to do what's best for me and not what I had to do, she said, not explicitly singling out either event. She's been critical of Trump in the past and has urged the world not to normalize him or his policies. The skipped engagements have been pointed to by conspiracy theorists who for months have claimed the pair are splitting up, sometimes with an also untrue side of accusations that Barack had an affair with Jennifer Aniston, a rumor that Vanity Fair reported the long tale of and debunked. On the podcast, Michelle continued that people couldn't even fathom that I was making a choice for myself, that they had to assume that my husband and I were divorcing. This couldn't be a grown woman just making a set of decisions for herself, right? She said. But that's what society does to us. Next thing you know, she'll have her own credit card and decide what to wear without her husband's approval. It's a slippery slope. Michelle recently launched a podcast of her own, co-hosted with her brother, Craig Robinson, called IMO with Michelle Obama and Craig Robinson. On the show's first episode, she talked about divorce, her brother's, and how hurt she was when her sibling didn't tell her about his split from his wife years ago. Representatives for Michelle and Barack Obama did not immediately return Vanity Fair's request for comment. Another in the news, the increasingly global case against Andrew Tate. The online personality has become even more visible of late. Allegations of sexual violence continue to mount. This is by Dan Adler on April 10th. In late 2014, a British woman saw a gun on influencer Andrew Tate's sofa, she recently claimed in a lawsuit. She told the BBC that she didn't mention seeing it, but she was a bit freaked out by it. When she slept with Tate, she said, the sex began as consensual, but then he strangled her until she lost consciousness and still continued. Another of the four women who filed the suit claimed that amid his daily threats while she worked for him, Tate waved a gun in her face, calling himself a boss and a G. You're going to do as I say, or they'll be held to pay, she claimed he said as he pointed the gun. On two other occasions, she said, Tate grabbed her by the throat and pinned her against the wall. As Tate has become a global force in recent years, his online rhetoric has become a familiar language. At the same time, allegations of his sexual violence have proliferated. Other accusations in the recent suit, which seeks damages arising from the assaults, batteries, and infliction of intentional harm, include a claim that Tate told a woman, "I'm just debating whether to rape you or not," before raping and strangling her. The case concerns incidents that occurred in the United Kingdom between 2013 and 2015. Tate, a 38-year-old dual U.S.-UK citizen, has denied the claims in a written response, calling them a pack of lies and gross fabrications, according to the BBC. When reached for comment, his British attorney referred Vanity Fair to that reply. Two of the four women worked for Tate's webcam business, while the other two were in the relationship with him. Three of the accusers reported Tate to the police, but criminal charges were not brought. In his response, Tate also said that too much time had elapsed for the women to take legal action against him. For about the last 2 years, Tate and his brother Tristan were on and off house arrest in Romania, where they faced charges of human trafficking and establishing a criminal gang to sexually exploit women. Tate has also been charged with rape, and the brothers deny all allegations against them. Florida recently opened a criminal investigation into the brothers, an effort Tate has described as trying to find crimes on an innocent man. That inquiry followed the brothers' brief return to the U.S. after their travel ban was lifted. In a recent California lawsuit, an ex-girlfriend of Tate's accused him of physical and sexual abuse during a 10-month relationship that began last year, which he has denied. In a statement to Vanity Fair, Tate's American attorney, Joseph McBride, compared his client to Donald Trump and Jesus, writing, "Andrew has formidable enemies who despise him, much like Trump's enemies despise Trump and Jesus's enemies despised Jesus." Andrew Tate is not without sin, he added. However, the idea that Andrew is a rapist or abuser of women is a fiction fabricated by his incel feminist enemies. A lawyer for Tate's four UK accusers told the BBC that his clients had been denied justice by the police and the Crown Prosecution Service while watching Andrew Tate's influence grow. One of the women said that watching the brothers travel in recent months was horrible to see. "Maybe men will look at him," she told the outlet, "and think, oh, well, if he can get away with that, then so can I." And it kind of makes it normalized. As Tate has reemerged in the early days of Trump's second administration, he has made the case for his innocence and relevance in some of the same alternative media quarters that the president sought out during his campaign press tour. During a recent interview with Fort Lauderdale entrepreneur and podcaster Patrick Bet David, Tate defended himself against criticisms lobbed by Dave Portnoy, Ben Shapiro, and Ron DeSantis. He also described the makeup of his audience, saying that he was used to hearing from people in Magnolia, Thailand, Singapore, Australia, and the Arab world. Of particular interest, he said, were hundreds of letters from women in Tennessee or Kentucky or Alabama who are raising their sons without a father and say that I help them teach their boys how to be men. In this sort of interview setting, Tate is often understood as a canny political observer. He and Bette David discussed Trump's intermittent proposal to instate the death penalty for drug dealers as a means of deterrence. "It's a solution," Tate says. "Often what you'll do," and I actually think Trump is smart enough to understand this, he says things that get people very emotionally upset. But what did we say earlier about the threat of violence? You won't need the death penalty if you have the threat of the death penalty. Now we're going to check in on the royals. First of all, Prince Harry makes a surprise visit to Ukraine. This is by Aaron Vanderhoof on April 11th. Days after Prince Harry made an appearance in a London courtroom, he traveled to Ukraine with a contingent from the Invictus Games Foundation for a surprise visit. During the Thursday trip, the prince met with wounded service members at Superhumans Center, a rehabilitation organization in Lviv that provides military personnel and civilians with free medical and psychological support. According to a spokesperson, Harry's visit came at the invitation of the organization's CEO, Olga Rudneva, who was present at the Invictus Games in Vancouver in February. And the Invictus Games group was joined by four veterans who have recovered from similar injuries. During his time at the center, Harry met with athletes who have participated in previous Invictus Games and spoke to Natalia Kalmyokova, Ukraine's Minister of Veterans Affairs. He also reunited with Yulia, or Tara, Pivska, a Team Ukraine competitor whose story was featured on the Duke's 2023 Netflix docuseries, Heart of Invictus. The prince spent Tuesday and Wednesday at the UK Court of Appeals in London, attending the latest hearing on his ongoing battle over security when he visits the United Kingdom. This week, Harry's lawyer, Shahid Fatima, argued that the government unfairly singled Harry out when it changed his security arrangements in 2020, following his and Meghan Markle's decision to step back from their royal duties that January. In response, the government's lawyer, Sir James Eadie, argued that the Duke and Duchess of Sussex's situation was a unique set of circumstances, per the BBC, and the government committee responsible for VIP security behaved appropriately considering the challenges. In her closing remarks Wednesday, Fatima said that Harry has pursued these legal challenges because he believes his safety is at risk. There is a person sitting behind me whose safety, whose security, and whose life is at stake, she said, as the prince sat two rows behind her in the courtroom. There is a person sitting behind me who has been told that he is getting a special bespoke process when he knows and has examined a process that is manifestly inferior in every respect. And the other royals, King Charles and Queen Camilla's marriage thrives on friendship and having their own bedrooms. As their majesties continue their tour of Italy, a royal commentator provides insight into how they've made their 20-year marriage work. This is by Aaron Vanderhoof on April 10th. This week, King Charles III and Queen Camilla celebrated their 20th anniversary with a romantic photo shoot in Rome and a 20-minute meeting with Pope Francis. The couple, who were married in an April 2025 civil ceremony 3 decades after they first met, have been showing off their close relationships through trips to iconic locations and jaunts for ice cream during their royal tour of Italy. As a sign of her affection, the Queen even re-wore her wedding dress on Wednesday. According to one commentator, their Majesty's relationship works well for a few simple reasons. They have known each other since they were very young and are great friends. There is no competitive edge between King Charles and Queen Camilla, broadcaster Helen Ashard told Fox News. They have also sussed out the best sleeping arrangements. At Clarence House, they are privileged to have their own bedrooms as well as their shared bedroom. Charles and Camilla first moved into Clarence House, which belonged to the Queen Mother for more than 40 years, in 2002. At the beginning of the King's reign in 2022, the couple decided that they would stay there rather than occupy Buckingham Palace, the monarch's traditional home, due in part to ongoing renovations which are expected to last until 2027. Charles and Camilla are not the only monarch and consort to have separate bedrooms in addition to a shared bedroom, and in fact, it was a practice that Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Philip also kept throughout their marriage. In the 19th and 20th century, it was common for members of the British aristocracy and royal family to keep separate bedrooms, whether or not their relationships were strong. In his 1991 memoir about his time serving as Lord Mountbatten's valet, William Evans explained that the practices derived from the diversity of their interests and duties between Mountbatten and his wife, Lady Edwina Mountbatten. Most of the royal family and British aristocracy followed suit, Evans wrote, because practical considerations override personal ones. When Charles and Camilla wed in 2005, 7 years after the death of Princess Diana, his mother did not attend the wedding because both were divorced. The couple chose a civil ceremony to avoid religious controversy, and as the head of the Church of England at the time, the late Queen reportedly believed she was not allowed to attend a non-religious wedding ceremony. The couple also owns separate country homes. Charles bought Highgrove Estate a year before his first marriage, and he and Diana were believed to sleep in separate bedrooms in that home. Before marrying Charles, Camilla had lived in her private home, Ray Mill House, and she has held onto the property ever since. Most years, she will spend a week vacationing in the house alone, and during the pandemic, her son Tom Parker Bowles quarantined in the house with his 2 children. Our next 2 articles are going to kind of segue into the politics section. Our first headline, Usha Vance is apparently loving her new role, Kennedy Center booze and all. This is by Casey Wickman on April 10th. Lucia Vance, the Second Lady of the United States and wife of Vice President J.D. Vance, didn't think anyone would notice, let alone care, when in March she and her husband headed out for a date night at the Kennedy Center. She thought wrong. In her first interview since Donald Trump moved back into the White House and she and her family took up residence in the Naval Observatory, Vance told the Free Press about getting booed by the crowd that night. It was about 20 or 30 seconds of some people booing and delaying the start of the concert, right as the conductor is about to come out. And there are a few other people clapping, Vance recalled, noting that someone shouted, "Oh, fuck him," up at their balcony seating, and someone else urged the building to kill that light to hide the couple from view. JD waved at them, and then we enjoyed the show that we had come for. This is just one of the ways that Vance, who elsewhere in the interview advocates for reading paper books and shares that her highest priority right now is to actually be a normal person, has had to adjust to her new life in its latest chapter. Her journey has already taken her to many previously unfamiliar territories. Yale, her husband's native Ohio, not Appalachia, as his detractors are quick to clarify, clerking for a pre-Supreme Court Brett Kavanaugh, one of two highly desirable clerkships with a super hot judge at the time, a former classmate told the Free Press, a white shoe law firm, and now Washington, D.C.'s most gilded halls. Despite the lengthy piece being her supposed formal introduction to the public, Vance, the woman whom Trump on his inauguration day called the only one smarter than J.D., remains largely mysterious. I would have chosen her, Trump said then, of choosing his vice president, but somehow the line of succession didn't work that way. She's great. Vance told the Free Press that it's a very strange life that we lead, where there are lots of people who have just imagined all sorts of narratives about us and what we think and what we do and why we do it and how much planning goes into it and all these sorts of things. The narrative offered by former law school classmate and pal James Imers, one of the few names sourced in the article, is that Vance is selfless and has a superhuman capacity to achieve. To demonstrate how nice she is, he told a story about furniture. In a somewhat ridiculous display of her devotion to a friend, Usha even went so far as to buy a table she didn't really need from a particular student in the class a year ahead of us, Imers told the Free Press. Usha knew that I had been looking for an unobtrusive scenario in which to ask the table seller on a date, and that, with the table purchase, I would be forced to retrieve and transport the table for her because I owned the only pickup truck and served as the unofficial nonprofit moving company of our class. Shortly thereafter, I did indeed pick up Usha's superfluous table, as well as a date with the table seller. The table's fate thereafter goes unmentioned. Vance, the nation's first Asian American and first Hindu second lady, has not yet announced a signature social cause for her time in the Trump administration, with her official White House bio describing her as a proud wife and mother of three beautiful children before touting her academic and legal bona fides, as well as love of orchestras. In the Free Press article, it's agreed that she's one of her husband's closest advisors, chatting with him about news and politics both in person and via text throughout the day. Despite that almost uniformly positive experience she touted so far, she did nod to the isolation of the role. I don't know that he's asking me for advice so much as it can be a very lonely, lonely world not to share with someone, she said. And our next headline, Trump wants to rewrite history at the Smithsonian. It'll be an uphill battle. The president's recent executive order directed at the institution will face a lot of procedural headwinds before he can magnify its approach to teaching the country its history. This is by Nate Freeman on April 11th. President Donald Trump wasn't always at loggerheads with the museums that make up the Smithsonian Institute. In February 2017, he arrived at the brand new National African American Museum of History and Culture for a tour with its director, Lonnie G. Bunch III, and told Bunch he'd been looking forward to it. His wife Melania had recently toured the museum with the First Lady of Israel, Sarah Netanyahu. After the visit, both women decried the historic plight of slavery, which the Jewish and African American people have known all too well. Trump had brought along Senator Tim Scott and Dr. Ben Carson, the latter a neurosurgeon and former Trump primary opponent who had an exhibit at the museum dedicated to his career. His daughter Ivanka and the niece of Martin Luther King Jr., Alveda King, who had supported Trump in the 2016 election. If the remarks after the tour are to be taken at face value, Trump had a pretty great time. This museum is a beautiful tribute to so many American heroes. Heroes like Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass, Booker T. Washington, Rosa Parks, the Greensboro students, and the African American Medal of Honor recipients, among so many other really incredible heroes, the then and future president said. And then, signaling out the museum's then director, Trump said, "I am very, very proud of Lonnie Bunch. The work and the love that he has in his heart for what he's done is, I always talk about you. You need enthusiasm. You need really love for anything you do and do it successfully. And Lonnie, you're where? Come on, where's Lonnie? You should be up here, Lonnie. Come on." A different anecdote from the day's tour stood out to Bunch years later. As he recalled in his 2019 memoir, A Fool's Errand, at one point during the day, the president stood in front of a display that described in detail how the Netherlands contributed to the first 200 years of the transatlantic slave trade. Trump stared at the text on the wall and then returned to Bunch. "You know, they love me in the Netherlands," Trump said. "Let's continue walking," Bunch replied. "I was so disappointed in response to one of the greatest crimes against humanity in history," he went on to write in the book, which carried the subtitle, Creating a National Museum of African American History and Culture in the Age of Bush, Obama, and Trump. Here was a chance to broaden the views and the understanding of the incoming president, and I had been less successful than I had expected. While the Netherlands episode didn't merit much of a response from the White House when the book was released, it's now at the center of an effort by the administration to infiltrate the heart of the Smithsonian and rid it of what it recently called this revisionist movement that seeks to undermine the remarkable achievements of the United States by casting its founding principles and historical milestones in a negative light. That choice quote comes from Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History, an executive order issued by Trump late last month that explicitly asked Vice President J.D. Vance to remove improper ideology from the Smithsonian through his perch on the institution's Board of Regents via statute. News coverage of the order anticipated the worst. Dictating the programming of an independent cultural organization would be completely unprecedented, like so much is these days, e.g., the private universities and law firms that have acquiesced to Trump's demands. Perhaps the leaders of the Smithsonian would as well? But Bunch, who has served as Secretary of the Smithsonian since 2019, was not ready to fold. Days later, he sent a memo to staff saying, "As always, our work will be shaped by the best scholarship, free of partisanship, to help the American people better understand our nation's history, challenges, and triumphs." Lonnie Bunch is a Democrat donor and rabid partisan who manufactured lies out of thin air in order to boost sales of his miserable book, Trump's smash mouth attack dog Stephen Chung told The Times. Fortunately, he, along with his garbage book, are complete failures. That's a long 7 years removed from very, very proud. A representative for Bunch declined an interview request for this story, citing his schedule. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are in the middle of an article about Trump rewriting the history at the Smithsonian Institute. Let's continue. It seems like a scary time at the Smithsonian. Last week, the NMAAHC, known colloquially as the Blacksonian, announced that Kevin Young, who succeeded Bunch as director, was stepping down permanently after spending the last few weeks on leave. Young is also the poetry editor and fellow Condé Nast title, The New Yorker. Early in the administration, the least two museums At least two museums closed their diversity departments. The Art Museum of the Americas canceled a show organized by Andil Gosin, the artist and author of the text Environmental Justice and Racism in Canada, and also canceled a show featuring artists from the African diaspora. But can Trump actually steamroll through the Smithsonian and call in diehard loyalists to eliminate ideology from the programming? Can he send 22-year-old culture-ignorant Doge staffers into the red brick Gothic castle that James Renwick built in 1855 and have them start gutting the place, a la you said? In what counts as good news these days, it might be tough for Trump to pull it off, and here's why. The Smithsonian is firewalled from changing administrations, protecting it from the vicissitudes of the executive branch, very much unlike the Kennedy Center, which has a board handpicked by the president and now has a U.S. president as its chair. Congress appoints the Smithsonian's governing regents, who are expected to serve years and sometimes decades long terms. The Smithsonian is much more insulated from presidential oversight or control than an administrative agency in the executive branch would be, said Richard H. Pildes, the Sudler Family Professor of Constitutional Law at the NYU School of Law. The president's theory behind this effort to assert control over the Smithsonian is, the Smithsonian is part of the executive branch, and the president should be understood to have full control and supervision over the running of the executive branch. But the Justice Department have concluded many times over the years that the Smithsonian is not part of the executive branch, that it's a unique entity from a legal perspective. One could argue that hasn't stopped Trump before. He could just act as a king and flout the law by declaring himself the new secretary of the Smithsonian and presiding over the Board of Regents, but that would likely face heavy legal headwinds. There would be legal challenges, Pildes said. The fundamental point is that the Smithsonian is not part of the executive branch, as the Justice Department has recognized for decades and decades. And so the parliamentary procedure must be followed, and that's an uphill battle for Trump. There are 17 members on the Board of Regents, and 6 are congressional figures. 3 senators selected by the president pro tempore, Chuck Grassley, and 3 representatives chosen by the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson. Regents generally stay in their positions until they leave office and are reappointed upon re-election. Senator Patrick Leahy served a full 2 decades, from 2001 to 2021. The current senators are John Boozman, Catherine Cortez Mastro, and Gary Peters, who announced he won't run for re-election, meaning a seat on the board will open in 2027, and the administration can pressure Grassley to appoint the MAGA-iest senator they can. Not that Grassley is a rubber stamp on the president's agenda. The 3 House members on the board are, of course, up for re-election and could hypothetically be replaced by Johnson, regardless of whether they win. Though, if the Democrats take the House, as odds makers are predicting, it would presumably be Hakeem Jeffries who will have the appointment power once their term end and can slot in Democrats to take the place of the current Republican reps on the board, Adrian Smith and Carlos Jimenez. Then there are citizen members of the board. This is central to the Trump's team's plan to seize the Smithsonian power. The executive order claims that Vance will work with the Speaker of the House of Representatives and the Senate Majority Leader to seek the appointment of citizen members to the Smithsonian Board of Regents, committed to advancing the policy of this order. There are several current regents who are set to step down when their 6-year term ends at various points over the next 18 months. Even if all 6 regents with terms ending in 2026 get replaced with right-wing cultural hardliners, they will get outvoted 10-7 when joined by Vance. Say, hypothetically, Trump tells the board to cancel a contemporary art show at the Hirschhorn that, when seen through Trump vision, has come under the influence of a divisive race-centered ideology, as the order vaguely states. In that scenario, they get outvoted. Got all that, Mr. President? Is there a way for Trump to get around this? One scenario that was suggested to me by a source is quite alarming because there's no statute claiming that the citizen members of the Board of Regents can only be fired for cause. Congress could vote to replace all 9 citizen members with people who pass for cultural heavyweights in MAGA world, your Steve Wynns and Lee Greenwoods and Kid Rocks. Again, Trump can't just snap his fingers and make this happen like he did with the Kennedy Center. It has to go through Congress. The margins are already razor thin, and you'd have to assume that Smith and Jimenez would not vote to kick their current fellow regents off the board. The votes determining the citizen regents who serve the Smithsonian are so bipartisan that it might not even be close. In 2023, when the House voted to reappoint 3 citizen regents, LACMA director Michael Govan, former News Corp executive Tony Bush, and former Fed vice chair Roger Ferguson, the tally was 390 yeas and only 10 nays. Representative Paul Gosar, the guy who posted an anime video of himself murdering Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, was one of them, nays. After Gosar was censured by his House colleague and removed from 2 committee assignments, he said, "There is no threat in the cartoon other than the threat immigration poses to our country, and no threat was intended by my staff or me." But if Trump decided to make this a priority, he could force Johnson to whip the votes in the House to kick out the citizen regents and install lackeys. That's way harder than using executive power to dismantle an agency, and he'd have to activate what's proven to be an extraordinarily ineffective Congress. But it's still a possibility, and with the 9 Trump-chosen citizen regents and Vance, they would outvote the holdovers 10-7. Our next headline, how screwed is Hollywood now that Trump is playing chicken with China? At least semi-screwed. This is by John Ross on April 11th. It's official. China is reducing the number of Hollywood films allowed to play in the country as part of its ongoing trade war with Donald Trump. Earlier this week, Bloomberg reported that China was considering a full-out ban on all Hollywood films, so maybe movie executives here should feel lucky that'll only be moderately reduced, as Bloomberg reports, the number of U.S. movies it imports. The wrong action of the U.S. government to abuse tariffs on China will inevitably further reduce the domestic audience's favorability toward American films, the China Film Administration said in a statement. What films will be targeted and how many? That remains to be seen. While Trump put many of his global tariffs on pause, he remains resolute on keeping enormous tariffs on China, having announced that they will increase to 125% from the initially proposed 104%. Some analysts have argued that China is no longer a major player in the global box office, but try telling that to last year's Alien, Romulus, which grossed approximately $110 million there, accounting for about 30% of its global total gross, according to Box Office Mojo. Without China, Romulus would have been a moderate success, but not a surprise hit. Just last week, Warner Brothers and Legendary's A Minecraft Movie opened number 1 in China with sales of $14.5 million, according to Deadline. In 2024, the biggest U.S. release in the country was another team up from Warner Brothers, and Legendary Godzilla vs. Kong, The New Empire, which grossed $132 million. These numbers are a lot more than rounding errors when it comes to calculating a film's success and its chances for a sequel. Sequels, of course, are still what most Hollywood execs dream about at night. China has been clamping down on Hollywood releases in the country for well over a decade, instead focusing on building its own film industry. Just this year, Ne Zha 2, a Chinese animated adventure film, grossed a staggering nearly $2 billion at the global box office. Even if the government has only partially limited the number of Hollywood films it will exhibit, it's striking a blow to the upcoming blockbuster summer season. The most worrisome issue here is that it isn't much Hollywood can do to appease the Chinese government. In the past, studios have agreed to make changes to their films to gain access to the Chinese market. Transformers: Age of Extinction, whose world premiere took place in Hong Kong, inexplicably features a Chinese ATM in a scene that takes place in Texas. Warner Brothers Discovery president and CEO David Zaslav initially praised Trump's election, saying that his policies could offer a pace of change and opportunity for consolidation. This probably isn't the change Zaslav wanted to believe in. Marvel, which will release Thunderbolts in May, and the revamped The Fantastic Four, First Steps, in July, has had issues with its film releasing in China before. Spider-Man No Way Home was barred from release. On the other hand, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 did get a release in China and wound up grossing over $86 million there, which ain't nothing at a time when a beleaguered Hollywood will take anything. Marvel just released a Thunderbolts international poster announcing an April 30th release date in China, but that could change if China decides to give the movie the axe as it reduces imports. This summer, the Marvel Cinematic Universe is at an inflection point. With Thunderbolts and Fantastic Four, the studio is introducing new characters it hopes audiences will connect with enough to energize its Phase 6 series of films, most notably with Avengers: Doomsday, now in production. With this much on the line, the thought of a bump in the road may be enough to make Hulk go smash. In July, Universal is soft rebooting. Is that what it's called? It's Jurassic franchise with the Scarlett Johansson-led Jurassic World Rebirth. The Jurassic series has done major business at the China box office. Jurassic World Dominion made over $157 million there. Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom over $261 million. And Jurassic World over $228 million. It could have great implications on the future of this relaunch if it cannot get a release in the country. The Mount Everest of recent box office success in China is, of course, Avatar: The Way of Water, which was the country's second highest grossing film of 2022, making over $245 million in China alone. With Avatar: Fire and Ash arriving this December, Disney surely wants to replicate those numbers. It's too soon to tell if the trade war will make that impossible. Our next headline in the political section is, "Hey Donald Trump, people are still yippy. The president's tariff turmoil is far from over." This is by Eric Lutz on April 11th. When Donald Trump backed off most of his tariff regime earlier this week, there was a brief moment of, well, I won't call it hope. That's too strong a word in these troubling times. Respite, maybe? A sense we could take a breather when it came to impending economic meltdown, even as the administration's assault on United States democracy and constitutional rights continue apace? Alas, after markets rallied Wednesday following his tariff turnabout, chaos reigned once again Thursday as Trump escalated his trade war with China, clarifying that Chinese goods exported to the U.S. would now face a minimum tariff rate of 145%. In response, first, Beijing announced retaliatory tariffs, 125% on all American goods, designed to inflict significant pain on consumers. Then, the dollar dropped, and so did U.S. stocks. The volatility continued as markets opened Friday with what analysts called a confidence crisis in the U.S. The global safe haven status is in question, Priya Misra, a portfolio manager at J.P. Morgan Asset Management, told the New York Times this week. To put that in Trumpese, people have been getting a little yippy. That was the president's stated reason Wednesday for suddenly calling off many of his so-called Liberation Day tariffs, at least for 90 days. And after the market swung back in response to his apparent de-escalation, he took a victory lap. "It was the biggest day in history, the markets," he said Thursday, touting the stock rebound from the plunge he personally caused. "So we're very, very happy with the way the country is running." But you could say that people are still yippy, as it were. His unpredictability, the sense that he could impose or pull back on these policies at any time, as he's already done at several points, not even 3 months into his presidency, has weakened Americans' reliability. "This is the worst self-inflicted wound that I have ever seen an administration impose on a well-functioning economy," former Fed Chair and Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said on CNN Thursday. Are Trump's actions the results of a misguided belief he can bend markets to his will the way he has with the U.S. political system? Or is this intentional market manipulation in service of grift, as it appeared to be when he told Truth Social followers it was a great time to buy Wednesday morning, just before he sent markets soaring with his trade war reversal. Whether it's one or the other or some combination of both, I would suspect it's most likely the latter. The chaos reinforces the need for real checks and balances on this administration. Even a handful of Republicans, normally so deferential to and afraid of this president, have signed onto a bill that would reassert congressional oversight of the chief executive's tariff powers. For too long, Congress has delegated its clear authority to regulate interstate and foreign commerce to the executive branch, Republican Chuck Grassley, a co-sponsor of the legislation, said in a statement calling for lawmakers to have a voice in trade policy. But it's not easy to claw back power once you give it up. Trump has said he'd veto the bill. Reckless improvisation is not a strategy, as former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers put it this week after Trump reversed course. We are far from being out of the woods. Next up, no pronouns allowed. White House ignores preferred pronouns and the journalists who use them. Elon Musk mocked pronouns as silly after Press Secretary Carolyn Leavitt said journalists who use pronouns in their bios do not care about biological reality or truth. This is by Katie Hirschenroder on April 12th. The wealthiest man in the world, Elon Musk, celebrated on his social media site X late Friday, writing that the pronoun BS is finally going away. That was silly. Musk, who heads up the Department of Government Efficiency, and has been slashing crucial federal funding for months, wrote after reposting a pronoun knock-knock joke. Thank God Trump won, a user named the Doge Glory replied below Musk's post, to which he responded with a bullseye emoji. Musk's post comes days after White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said that administration officials would refrain from responding to inquiries from journalists to include their preferred pronouns in email signatures or bios. As a matter of policy, Leavitt wrote in an email from a reporter asking about the closure of a research observatory, "We do not respond to reporters with pronouns in their bios." President Donald Trump's administration in January instructed federal employees to remove any reference to their identifying pronouns from their email signatures and other forms as a part of the broad effort to roll back any and all evidence of diversity, equity, and inclusion, or, as the Texas state employee found out, get fired. Leavitt's admission this week confirms that the press office is following suit. Any reporter who chooses to put their preferred pronouns in their bio clearly does not care about biological reality or truth, and therefore cannot be trusted to write an honest story, the press secretary, who in just a few short months since Trump has taken office, has gained a reputation as combative toward both individual journalists and legacy media in general, said in a statement to other news outlets. Axios also confirmed on Wednesday that officials will continue to skirt these reporters, asking Trump's spokesperson Harrison Fields if that was now their official policy. Facts, he replied. As the New York Times reported this week, on at least three recent occasions, senior Trump press aides have refused to engage with reporters' questions because the journalists listed identifying pronouns in their email signatures. A spokesperson for The Times said, "Evading tough questions certainly runs counter to transparent engagement with free and independent press reporting." But, they continued, refusing to answer a straightforward request to explain the administration's policies because of the formatting of an email signature is both a concerning and baffling choice, especially from the highest press office in the U.S. government. In one instance, Matt Berg, a reporter at Crooked Media, the network that runs the Pod Save America family of podcasts, decided to experiment with the new administration's handling of journalists to include their pronouns. Berg doesn't usually include pronouns in his email signature, but when he included he/him in an email to Katie Miller, a senior advisor at Doge, he too was met with a response claiming that the use of pronouns is detrimental to science, that it was her policy to refuse to respond to journalists with listed pronouns, and that he was ignoring facts. "I find it baffling that they care more about pronouns than giving journalists accurate information, but here we are," Berg said in an email to The Times. The press office has previously been harsh on reporters who do not use the language they prefer. In February, Leavitt and the administration blocked the Associated Press from covering multiple White House events because it refused to change its editorial style from Gulf of Mexico to Gulf of America. The AP sued Leavitt and two other White House officials on First Amendment grounds and won, though the White House said it would be appealing. The White House's handling of pronouns aligns with the president's coordinated rollback of protections for transgender and non-binary Americans and those who support them. Trump has signed several executive orders targeting transgender people. In his first moments in office, the president signed an order declaring that United States would only recognize two sexes, male and female, as defined at conception, a move that required government agencies to use an outdated and scientifically inaccurate gender binary on documents like passports, visas, and employee records. He also signed others aimed at barring transgender student athletes from playing on girls' sports teams, restricting funding for gender-affirming care for people under 19, and removing transgender service members from the military. Multiple of Trump's orders against transgender people are being challenged in the courts. For Musk, this isn't the first time he's discussed preferred pronouns on X, formerly Twitter. In 2022, he wrote, "My pronouns are prosecute/Fauci. And in June of 2023, on the first day of Pride Month, Musk said that he would allow users to intentionally misgender someone without consequence. He also claimed that he personally would use the pronouns that someone prefers for manners' sake, something that he has repeatedly chosen not to do with his own daughter. Our next headline, Trump adds thousands of living immigrants to Social Security's death file. The Social Security Administration reportedly added 6,300 people, including minors, to its death master file, who are not in fact dead and had legal immigration status before Trump revoked it this week. This is by Izzy Lepowski on April 11th. The Trump administration is reportedly adding thousands of living people who previously had temporary legal status in the U.S. to a list of dead people maintained by the Social Security Administration, the New York Times reports. In adding them to the so-called death master file, the administration is treating these people, whose legal immigration status the Trump administration revoked, as if they're dead, invalidating the Social Security numbers they use to work and live. As Acting Secretary of the SSA, Lee Dudek, put it in an email to staff, according to the Times, their financial lives are effectively terminated. Already, 6,300 names have been added to the list, according to the Times. The administration says these people are either criminals or terrorists, but the rest of Trump's slapdash, error-riddled immigration enforcement suggests disastrous mistakes are inevitable. The potential for errors can be very consequential, Jason Fitchner, who worked for the Social Security Administration under George W. Bush, told the Times. In a statement to the Times, a White House spokesperson said that President Trump is removing the monetary incentive for illegal aliens to come and stay, and that the move was meant to encourage them to self-deport. But in this case, the people in question came to the country under President Biden's parole program, which granted them temporary legal status and Social Security numbers that enable them to work. According to the Times, a software engineer working for Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency sent the Social Security Administration the list of 6,300 people to be added to the death file on Tuesday, the very same day their legal status was revoked. While the engineer reportedly said all the names were on the terrorist watch list or had FBI criminal records, a source told the Times the list also included several minors, including one as young as 13. That DOGE is heavily involved in this high-stakes effort is particularly notable, given its well-documented track record of misinterpreting data. Dudek has already had to walk back Elon Musk's claims of 150-year-olds collecting Social Security benefits. The reported data are people in our records with a Social Security number who do not have a date of death associated with their record, Dudek said in February. These individuals are not necessarily receiving benefits. DOGE has also made a series of errors in reporting supposed government savings on its so-called wall of receipts. It's one thing for Doge to mistake an $8 million contract for an $8 billion contract, as it once did. It's another thing entirely to mistake an innocent person for a terrorist. And as this administration has made abundantly clear, it's not particularly interested in correcting its mistakes. The last section today is actually going to be Bernadette Peters answering the Proust questionnaire. The Broadway legend talks about high-maintenance dogs, Chinese philosophy, and her love for Stephen Sondheim. This is by Bernadette Peters, April 9th. Vanity Fair asks, "What is your idea of perfect happiness?" Bernadette Peters answers, "A peaceful, joyous time in the world, or in my head." Which historical figure do you most identify with? Well, not identify as such, but I love his quotes. Lao Tzu. Here's one. "He who knows that enough is enough will always have enough." Which living person do you most admire? I most admire Steve Sondheim, who is not alive anymore, but his words and music keep him alive. What is the trait you most deplore in others? People's need to feel superior to others. All it does is cause judgment and hate. What is your greatest extravagance? Taking care of the two beautiful souls who are my dogs, which I don't consider an extravagance at all. What is your favorite journey? Traveling to Africa on safari. You can't imagine just how amazing it is. And then going to Rwanda to visit the gorillas. They say hi, by the way. What or who is the greatest love of your life? Top of the list is my husband, Tom. Then, of course, Charlie. You know who you are. Woof. Which talent would you most like to have? I would love to be able to play the piano really, really well. Can you imagine sitting down and filling a room with Mozart or Beethoven? If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? One of Bernadette Peters' dogs, of course. They live the best lives ever. I'm telling you, you should all sign up. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? When you have no love or compassion left for yourself, terrible things happen. When and where were you happiest? I have a lot to be grateful for, but right now, being married, having time to be with my husband and his children, I feel very grateful. Who are your heroes in real life? People who decide to make a difference and do something to change things when help is needed, like the man who built Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS, Tom Viola. What do you most value in your friends? Trustworthiness, honesty, and a deep understanding of emotions. Who are your favorite writers? I love Elizabeth Strout. Her characters all intertwine. You don't have to read all of her books, but I do. I'm always looking for the next one. What is your favorite occupation? I'm so lucky I'm doing it. What a privilege. This brings us to the end of our time together here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for tuning in. I invite you to join me next week. We'll have another full hour of stories from vanityfair.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and have a great week.